Lights, camera, action.
And the winner is...
Welcome back to the Oscar Reel Movie Podcast, where we discuss and review past, present, and potentially future Oscar-related movies. I am your Oscar know-it-all and movie-loving host, Matthew Schmidt, and I am joined by my co-host and recently converted movie lover wife, Haley. This is our second-to-last episode of the 2021 Best Picture nominees. I would label these two movies today as the big studio-slash-budget nominees. We have the sci-fi epic scale of a movie in Dune, the latest from the rising star Denis Villeneuve, who can't seem to miss at the time, which is the latest adaptation of the beloved 1965 sci-fi book. Also, we have the latest from Steven Spielberg in West Side Story, a remake of a Best Picture winner of two star-crossed lovers in this New York updated take on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. As far as Oscar goes for these two, they are heavy hitters in the technical categories. The effects in Dune, the music in West Side Story, and the production design in both could get them some wins. Also, West Side Story is the clear favorite for Best Supporting Actress for Ariana DeBose, who plays Anita. With Dune getting snubbed for Best Director nomination, I don't see it winning anything outside of some technical awards. Up front, these are my two favorite movies as it stands with the Best Picture nominees that we've reviewed so far. So sit back and hear us talk about some great movies. All right, on with the reviews.
Our next Best Picture nominee is none other than Dune. Highly anticipated. Many delays, many dismays. This one had been pushed back a few times due to COVID. Finally came out. Director here is Denis Villeneuve. Love saying that name. It's a good one. He also worked on the screenplay as well. Acting, we've got Timothée Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Zendaya, Oscar Isaac, Jason Momoa, Stellan Skarsgård, Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, Dave Bautista. Lots of names in this one. With those names, with these effects, $165 million budget. Mm-hmm. But they have raked in over $400 million worldwide.
Which is like, it probably is just over even. Because, like, you know, double the budget and all that stuff. And then with the delays, I'm sure that didn't help. But out of all the movies we've been reviewing so far, this is the first one that's one of the first ones that's looking more on the positive side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for sure. This has been a heavy hitter for awards season, especially once we look at the nominations for the Academy Awards, the BAFTAs. Golden Globes were first to kick off this year. It was nominated for Best Picture. Denis Villeneuve was nominated for Best Director. The lone winner at the Globes was Hans Zimmer for the original score. That's exciting. As far as the SAGs go, the only nomination they had at the Screen Actors Guild was the Stunt Ensemble, mm-hmm. which you and I looked at the list. It's like 80 names or something. So
yeah, I don't even... Stunt Ensemble seems like a made-up award.
So they're nominated for that. No wins at the SAGs. BAFTAs are just held. They had 11 total nominations. They won for cinematography. Hans Zimmer won again for score. Production design, visual effects, sound. Other nominations included best film, screenplay, casting, costume design, editing, makeup and hair. Pretty much everything under the sun, which is pretty similar
to... Was it nominated for best director at the BAFTAs? Did you say that?
No.
Okay. All right. Go on.
But yeah, if we look at the Academy Award nominations, they have 10, including best picture, adapted screenplay, original score, costume, sound, editing, makeup and hair, cinematography, production design, and visual effects.
Yeah, because I was asking, because I'm surprised that Denis Villeneuve didn't get an Oscar and BAFTA nomination. Because I thought he did a really good job with this movie.
So that surprised me.
I'm not great at picking up on the, oh, what has it not been nominated for? But that's...
No, yeah, acting that's nominations huge. Either.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily surprised by that.
It's like a sci-fi movie instead of an acting movie. I get that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Usually if it's a heavy hitter, they'll try to find one to throw in. But yeah.
Yeah, good point. As far as ratings go, IMDb is currently at an 8.1. Rotten Tomatoes score, the critics is at 84% and audience at 90%. The Metacritic score is currently 74. Any surprises looking at those ratings?
No, I mean, that's pretty... It's tied for the highest IMDb score with Coda out of all the nominees. Like, I would want it to be higher, but ultimately it's like a sci-fi movie. And it's only half a movie. Like, we'll talk about...
Yeah, so, half the story.
So, I'm not too surprised. If it was any lower or any higher, I would be surprised.
We got some trivia, mm-hmm. some facts.
I got some.
Some knowledge we want to share.
I got some.
Okay.
So, up front, it was, you mentioned it's a COVID delay. It was originally supposed to be December 2020. Got pushed to October 2021. And it was simul-released on HBO Max. The same day it was released in theaters, which Denis Villeneuve did not like. Based on how well this movie did in the box office, essentially, he was told would be whether he got a sequel to it or not. But... So he wasn't upset when it was going to be put on streaming. But Hans Zimmer is such a big fan of the novels, he turned down doing Tenet with Nolan to do this instead.
Isn't that wild?
And Denis Villeneuve was like, this was his dream to make Dune into a movie. Cool. Like, he grew up as a huge fan of the books too,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Like, if you have people that care about it, that's obviously better than not. Caladan, the Atreides homeworld, was shot in Norway. Arrakis or Dune was shot in Jordan. Denis said he saw the Baron, who Stellan Skarsgård plays in this, he's like the main villain, as a rhino of a man. So Skarsgård spent 7 hours a day in makeup accommodate.
That's awful.
And he doesn't even, like, he's an enormous man and very bald, but he doesn't look like someone who would have been in a chair for 7 hours.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
But probably, like, the body prosthetics and stuff. Like, that's gotta take a while.
True. He's just not... He's, like, in the shadows a lot, too, though. So, it was just... I was just surprised to see that number.
Yeah. And he's in so few scenes. I hope that it was, like, he was on set for, like, a week at most. And it's like, okay, now you're done.
Right.
Like, it sounds awful sitting in a chair for 7 hours doing hair and makeup, whatever. But hopefully he only had to do that, like, 2 or 3 times.
Right.
For, the two scenes he's in.
Yeah. I was just surprised by that number. But Rhino of a Man, I think that describes that character pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, an intimidating, like, giant creature.
Have you read the book?
I read the book a while ago. I was planning on rereading it for when this was going to be released in 2022. And then when I saw it got delayed, I was like, all right, I'll read that later. I never really got back to it, but I do plan on rereading it.
Okay.
People didn't realize, I mean, I don't think this is a spoiler, but people apparently didn't realize that this was going to only be a part of the book until the premiere of the film and the words Dune Part 1 came up on screen. Like, they always knew that a sequel was possibly in the works, but this is a book series. So I think people assumed that it was just going to be the next book. But yeah, apparently no one knew that the book was essentially cut in half until Part 1 came up on the screen.
Yeah.
So, which I was surprised by too. When that came up, when I saw it, I just went, did I know that? Did I know that this was cut in half? This reunites Zendaya and Rebecca Ferguson from which movie?
The Greatest Showman.
Yep, which I don't know if they even share a scene together in The Greatest Showman or this.
Like, talking to each other?
Yeah.
They don't talk to each other in The Greatest Showman, but, like, because Zendaya is part of the circus, like, when they see Rebecca Ferguson's character perform, like, they're in the same room together, sure. But person's on stage. So yep. It's not like they talk to each other.
But then I don't think in this they don't really share. No. Zendaya is really not in this
movie.
She is
not in this.
She is like third billing. She is not in this movie. A lot of those stars are not like in this movie, actually.
Honestly, that was the first thing I heard about this movie when Dune came out. Everyone's like, really? I waited that long to see Zendaya? And she's like, not even in it? Yeah. I was like, oh, okay.
Yep.
It's one thing I knew about Dune before I saw this.
Mm-hmm. Josh Brolin and Javier Bardem reunited from...
No Country for Old Men.
Fellow Best Picture winner, No Country for Old Men. And there's probably others just because of like the MCU. Zendaya, Josh Brolin are all in
Dave
Bautista. There's probably more are all in the MCU, but those are the two that like I wanted to point out. So that's what I had for trivia. We can get into some quick general thoughts.
Well, what about my trivia?
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course you have trivia. What trivia do you have?
Miss Jeopardy woman over here. Of course I've got trivia. Well, I'd say I didn't find this to be like super interesting, but now we've already talked about Charlotte Rampling. She's bilingual, so she dubbed her own parts in the French dubbing version of Dune. So
that's always cool.
Yeah, I don't know if we said this. I think I told this to you, like, outside of the podcast, but very similarly, the actor who plays the music teacher in Coda, same thing. He dubbed his own lines for the, like, Spanish release.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Facts. Here we go. Hans Zimmer. We talked about how this is, like, a lifelong dream of his to do Dune.
Mm-hmm.
He, so committed, he spent a week out in the desert by himself. Just listening to the sounds of the desert.
Nice.
So that he could incorporate and be inspired for the score.
I don't know what that means. Like, I mean, I get, like, I know what it means, but, like, what is, like...
Just, you know, you got listen to the sounds of, like, the sand, the wind.
I feel like you could watch a YouTube video and get all those same sounds.
It's not the same. He's an artist. Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
An award. He's cleaning house with this original score nomination.
Okay.
It's paying off. Here's a little Food Network tie-in for you. The 1984 David Lynch version was produced by none other than Dino De Laurentiis, Jada's grandfather.
Oh.
Father? Yeah. I gotta double check.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, her grandfather.
Ooh, all right, there you go.
So there you go. When that Jodorowsky guy, when the rights, when he lost the rights to it, Dino De Laurentiis, the one who picked it up.
All right, nice.
Love that shit. Then the other thing, this is something that's always fascinating to me with these, like, science fiction, made-up worlds, made-up names, languages, everything. The linguistics expert who worked on this to help create the Fremen language, his name is David J. Peterson. He also created the Dothraki and Valyrian languages for Game of Thrones, for the TV show.
Jason Momoa.
I watched there you go, there's a tie-in too. I remember seeing a clip of something... like, years ago, I think it was related to Star Wars, like, one of the, like, Star Wars releases, and they talked to, like, a linguistics person, like, how do you create fictitious languages for, like, TV and movie, and it's crazy how people do it. I think that'd be really cool, like, if I were good at that, I think that'd probably be really fun.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Create your own language for, you know, these fictional places.
Mm-hmm. They always sound cool too. Yeah, when you sing them.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's what I got.
Nice. All right, some quick general thoughts before we get into more spoilery specific things of the movie. I mean, to me, so Ty Burr, who is a pretty well known critic, he called this Lawrence of Arabia in space. That's pretty close, right? Like, it's obviously desert, which makes sense. Lawrence viewed himself as a prophet, leading these, like, native people, and that's kind of what, Paul is, a prophet.
Timothée Chalamet's character.
Yeah, Paul Atreides is a pseudo-prophet, and it isn't, you know, we'll get into it, not so much in this movie, but he ends up leading a band of natives of the desert against their oppressors who are, you know, not, like, of the desert, like, the, you know, the Arabs do to the Turks and, you know, not so much the British, I guess, in Lawrence of Arabia. But, but yeah, this outsider who comes into the world of the natives and becomes, like, their leader and prophet in a desert world. I mean, it's basically Lawrence of Arabia. You're just giving me that look because Lawrence of Arabia has camels and this has dragonfly spaceships.
No, it's just that was not the first comparison I would have thought of. I'm like, where is this going? But hearing you explain it, I can see it.
I don't think it's a coincidence either that the book came out in 1965. Lawrence of Arabia came out in 1962. It was probably influenced.
Oh, okay. Okay, I gotcha.
But a lot of people who are not superhero fans, superhero movie fans, are in love with this movie. Like a friend of mine, I've heard some other critics, like Adnan, who used to be a VSPN, they don't like superhero movies, but they love this movie. Got some news from this is a superhero movie. Like, he has powers, he is a prophet-like character.
He's a savior.
It's like this. Messiah. This is person. A super. It's on the superhero scale. Like maybe it's lower on the scale than an Iron Man or an Avengers film. But like this has superhero features to it, and I think people just kind of need. And even Denis Villeneuve, like he kind of bashed Marvel a little bit, like every director does these days. Apparently, like you made Blade Runner 2049 and Arrival, which has aliens. And Dune, like, these are not far off from, like, a superhero movie.
Right, right.
I think people like, oh no, it's a science fiction movie. There's, like, a technology explanation to some of these things that happen. It's kind of the same thing. It's all in the same realm. And I think people need to just be okay with that. But no, I think the movie looks great. Like, you mentioned all the technical awards it's getting. Yeah. Rightfully so. That's kind of the thing that hits you in the face of this movie, right? Like, you need to go see it in theaters because it's, like, a spectacle of a viewing. It's maybe not there for the acting performance. Although I think everyone in this movie is great. I think Jason Momoa is in that perfect role of, like, sidekick, so he can be funny but kind of a badass at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it's made to be, like, viewed on a grand scale. So all the technical awards make sense. I think it's as grounded as it can be, because the 84 Dune version was silly, almost. Like, you know, it's like their outfits were kind of punk rock with spikes, and the Baron, the Harkonnens had red hair that was, like, stylized. Like, it was a really weird stylized world that just seemed fake. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, obviously it's fake because it's sci-fi, but, like, it seems like a real version of, like, what it could be. Like, it's hard to explain, but, like, the still suits look awesome, again, have a great design to them, the ships all look cool and, like, look sleek, a lot of it, I think, looks similar to Blade Runner 2049, which is kind of funny. Yeah. Like, the house they live in on Arrakis or Dune, like, has that pyramid look to it, yeah, which is almost the same as Blade Runner. But that's not a bad thing. It was just something I noticed. So I don't know. The way it looked just looked, I don't know, more realistic or grounded. And maybe it's technology just catching up to everything. But it just, especially when you compare it to some older versions of this, like, I just think it just looked great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best quality of this movie is the visual aspect. You just see the immense scale of everything and, like, the beauty, but the, like, treachery of the landscape. Like, the desert's, like, it's pretty, but there's a lot of, it's a word I'm looking for, but, like, there's danger out there, and yeah. I think they show that. Like I said, the costuming and the sets and everything is good. That being said, like, for me, I thought the story isn't confusing. It's actually a very basic story. It's very similar to, like, Pocahontas and stuff like that. It's a simple story, but I had to see it twice and have multiple explanations of what's going on for me to understand what's going on. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know if that's just me being stupid, if that's me not knowing anything about Dune beforehand, was very lost the first time seeing it. So seeing it again, I had some explanation. I will say, like, I enjoyed it more, and I think, like, stuff made more sense. But my first watch through, I was like, I am so lost as to what's going on and who the different people are and stuff. But it doesn't take away from, like, the visual aspects of it.
Yeah, the second time we watched it was with my dad, who's, like, the biggest Dune super fan out there. So as we're watching it, he's just going...
He, too, spent a week out in the desert just listening to the sounds. No, I'm just kidding.
but, like, as we're watching, he's just going, oh, yeah, so that's this, that, like, he's talking through it, so maybe that helped. What'd you think of the political aspect? Because I know with Star Wars, you're sometimes like, I don't know what's going on politically with these movies. Like, it's just kind of whatever. What did you think about that in this movie?
Like, it, like, honestly, it was something that I wasn't picking up on.
Okay.
Without explanation.
Okay. Because I thought it did a pretty good job of setting it up.
It's tough when it's like, you know this about me. I daydream a lot during movies. And especially movies like this where it's like there's a lot, like, visually going on. Like, I'll focus on something and I'll be like, oh, okay. And it's like, okay, there was one sentence where they said, like, hey, here's what's going on. And it's like, if I miss that, I'm lost. So that's something that was tough for me in this movie. Mm-hmm. It's like at the beginning, Paul, Timothée Chalamet, is narrating, like, oh, this is Arrakis, and the Harkonnens were here.
I think it's Zendaya, because she's like, they oppressed my people.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Whatever.
I was lost. I don't even know who was saying it. But, you know, and it's like, here's a one-liner that sets up the entire movie, and I did not pick up on what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I get lost very easily with, like, fake names for things. So I'm just like, okay, is this a person? Is this a place? These are types of people? Oh, that's the name of a ship? That stuff, like, really throws me off. So this is not my style of movie.
Mm-hmm. See, and we're opposite. This is my exact style of movie. Yes. I love this shit. Like, the opening is very exposition. Like you said, it's Zendaya, like, just talking about what's going on. But in a world like this where there is a lot going on, I think it kind of needs it. So, yeah, it's like the spice is the greatest resource in the world because its existence allows for space travel. So that's why, and Arrakis is the planet that has the most spice, so that's why the Harkonnens are, like, filthy rich.
Mm-hmm.
So, I like, you know, they mentioned the Emperor a couple times. He's not in this movie. He will be in the next movie, because he has a character in the book.
See, stuff like that, too. It's like, okay, there's an Emperor, and there's one scene where it's like, oh, hey, here's this guy who's, like, shown up, and he's got this, like, long scroll. Yeah. So this gotta be the Emperor, right? Nope.
Nope, messenger.
Like, what? Okay.
And I like
that. I thought I was figuring something out, but I'm not. So now I'm just discouraged.
No, and I like that. And I actually like that scene too, because that's Oscar Isaac, who plays Leto or Leto. I know I get those mixed up. Father of Paul Atreides is like, how much did this cost? Like, this extravagant, worthless thing. And then, like, you know, he's got his, like, human computer that tells him, and it's like, what a waste of money. Like, yeah. I like how it kind of sets up what kind of the mindset of the Atreides family of, like, they're not necessarily into the extravagant stuff. It's like, just do the right thing or whatever. But, I totally get where you're coming from. This is just, like, we're polar opposites in this, where this is my exact thing that I love. Like, so that's why I'll probably give this a higher score than your average person, or you included. My score is a 9.5. I'll say it right now. This is my, of the best picture movies, at least, this is my favorite one. And it's only half a movie, too. So, yeah.
It's a full movie.
It's two and a half hours long. But
45 minutes.
And really, it's only, I know, right? And really, it's only a third of the book. Like, we were talking about it with my dad. I'm like, yeah, this is not even half. There's a lot that they have to do in this next movie. I really, really like it a lot.
I give it 7. You gave your score
9.5.
Right? 9.5. Okay, I'm like, I guess it doesn't matter. I could have given my score first, too. I give it a 7.7. It's good. It's not a movie that I'm going to rave about. It's just not my thing.
This movie is the inspiration for Star Wars. George Lucas, say whatever you want. A lot of original Star Wars content came from Dune. And, I don't know, I just felt like the need to point that out, I guess. But, no, that's fair. Like, right, movies are subjective. I can't yell at someone for not liking it, but...
Don't yell at me!
But I can respect your opinion and then tell you you're wrong anyways.
Aww.
But, no, I mean, that's fair. Before getting into spoilers, I thought maybe I'd run through a little history of Dune on the screen.
Yeah.
So, because there's been a couple adaptions. This movie was deemed unfilmable at one point, but then we got probably the best version you could get. So let's just run through what happened. So the first book, because it's a series of six, came out in 1965, and the rights to a movie were in the works almost immediately. As of 1971, the book had already been deemed unfilmable because of the breadth of content, the book status with fans, because people felt any deviation from the book would be thought of as harmful to the movie, because people loved the book so much. They're just like, if you change anything in this, we're going to be pissed.
You say the book came out in 1965?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Alejandro Jodorowsky, I might be saying that wrong, probably am, got the rights to make a 14-hour adaptation.
What?
In the 70s, but that fell through.
As like a limited series type thing?
I don't,
or
it
what?
Had to be, because there's no way it could be a 14-hour movie.
No.
But that fell through,
apparently. Even like a saga of like five movies.
Right.
That's, okay, wow, crazy.
Apparently a 2013 doc was made about it. That's pretty good. About like this guy wanting to make that series,
really?
And it ultimately falling through.
That would be fascinating.
And then David Lynch came out with his 1984 version. Originally it was a 3-hour movie. It was cut to 137 minutes, which is like a little over 2 hours. Poorly received, poorly, like, critics and audiences alike, box office, it was just a total misfire. People say they like it now, that is got to be ironically, or something. I remember, like, when I was talking about this movie, my cousin Seamus was like, there's already a perfect Dune movie out there. No, you may like that movie ironically if you want,
yeah.
But you are wrong, that is not a good movie. In 1996, Richard Rubenstein acquired the rights and produced the miniseries that came out in 2000, which I've seen and I think is actually really good. It was made by Sci-Fi, so it's like a Sci-Fi original, came out on TV. It was a ratings hit overall, got better reviews than Lynch's. It's a TV movie, so it's not great effects, but like it's close to the book. The only criticism was maybe it was too long because it was a 3-hour miniseries, so it maybe got bogged down in exposition a little bit. William Hurt was in that, RIP. He recently passed away, but he played the dad, Leto Atreides, in that movie. Hmm. They also made a sequel which combined the second and third book a couple years later on Sci-Fi, which was also a hit, and that was James McAvoy, one of his first movies, was in that. And then after Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter came out, the idea of making a good version of Dune started, like, coming back to life a little bit.
Because people are like, hey, people have been able to adapt these.
Well, I think special effects is probably the biggest thing. But, yeah, like, those are adaptations of books as well. So, you're right, that probably had something to do with it. Lord of the Rings seems to be, like, the benchmark for effects.
Isn't that right?
That's what James Cameron saw that and went, I can make Avatar now.
Yep.
And
because of Gollum, right?
Yep. So that was like a big benchmark. In 2008, Paramount bought the rights and brought on Peter Berg to make it. Mm-hmm. Which, let me look up with Peter Berg.
Like Friday Night Lights, Peter Berg, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I want to look up what his... It was 2008, so I want to see what movie he had just come out with. Because I don't even know what he... Like, Friday Night Lights had to have come out by then. He did, The Rundown. So, Friday Night Lights was 04, The Kingdom, which is an okay movie. Desert movie takes place. It's like a military movie in Iraq or Afghanistan. So, maybe that's why they thought he could do it. But then Hancock in 08, so... Kind of, I don't know, he was off the heels of Hancock. They were looking at him going, yeah, you can make Dune. That he left the project in 2009... And then Legendary Studios got the rights in 2016 and immediately signed Denis Villeneuve to make it. And then that's where we're at now. It is, I mentioned, a six-book series. The first one came out in 65, Dune Messiah, which is the second book, came out in 1969. Children of Dune, 76. God Emperor Dune, 81. Heretics of Dune, 84. And then Chapter House of Dune, 85. So,
wow.
There was still a book to come out when David Lynch came out with his movie, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't spoil things. Name me one thing that I've actually spoiled.
But so that's just a history of Dune on the screen. The story, really quick, it is, though, I mean, spoilers. This is, we've mentioned it, but it's only a third of the book. It's a story about, you know, it takes place, they say it, but, like, obviously thousands of years into the future.
Yeah, I want to say it's, like, the year 10,000 something.
Right. And the Harkonnens, it opens with the Zendaya narration. She is a native of Arrakis, which is the planet, like, the nickname of that planet is Dune, because it's a desert planet. And her people are called the Fremen, and the Harkonnens are the bad guys of the movie. They are Stellan Skarsgård, Dave Bautista. They're a family that was gifted the planet of Arrakis by the Emperor to produce spice, because, like, spice is the thing that fuels space travel, so it's the richest resource in the galaxy. So their job is to farm it, mine it on the planet, and then send it off to the spacing guild. So they're filthy rich, because, like, they're in charge of the richest, you know, substance in the universe. And then out of nowhere, the Emperor says, you're not in charge of the planet anymore. We're giving it to the Atreides, who is Oscar Isaac's family, Timothy Chalamet's his son, Rebecca Ferguson's not his wife, but his concubine and the mother of his son. So they're gifted Arrakis. They don't really know why. They're just like, okay, the Emperor's giving us this planet. We're going to become rich. We're going to do it. Josh Brolin plays his bodyguard, Gurney. And then Jason Momoa is like the head of his, I guess, kind of army. Like, he trains the army. He's like, his name is Duncan Idaho. The only character in all the books, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yep. He dies in this movie, but he comes back as a clone in every single book.
Oh, so, wow. All right.
Only character to be in every book. So they go to Dune. All the equipment's busted. They think they got sabotaged by the Harkonnens. They, you know, try to get the spice ramped up. Eventually it's revealed that the Emperor, who is a very jealous and egotistical person, wants the Atreides family killed, because they're one of them, and the Harkonnens are one of the few power families in the galaxy that could pose a threat to the throne, to the Emperor. And people love the Atreides. They're like, they're good people, they're rich people, like, they're kind to everyone, they're just a good family. And the Emperor doesn't like that. He thinks that that's the sign of someone, like, that's a family that could overthrow me. Like, if they have people that truly believe in and like them, they could overthrow me. So, ironically, because the Harkonnens are the villains and greedy people, the Emperor actually asks the Harkonnens to kill the Atreides. So, the big climax of the movie is the Harkonnens, like, coming down and invading the Atreides in the middle of the night and killing off their entire army. Killing Oscar Isaac, Leto Atreides, like, the head of the family, killing him, too. And then, but Paul and his mom are able to escape into the desert, where they try to meet up with the Fremen, the native people, to just, you know, survive. So the movie actually ends with them finding those people, and then Paul has, like, a little duel with one of them, because he views him as an outsider and doesn't want him, like, with the group, so he kind of challenges them to a fight, but Paul kills him. And that's basically how the movie ends. Which I think is a decent place to end it. I heard some criticism over, like, where it ended. I don't really know where people think a better place to end it would be. It's like, yeah, introduce this group of people who are going to be who he's with. Like, the next movie's probably going to flash forward, like, a couple months or a year or something. I don't know. I think it's a pretty natural spot to end it. But I heard some criticism over that. I don't really agree with it. But yeah, that's kind of just a short nutshell. What's going on? There's a lot they gotta pack into this next movie, but I'm sure it's gonna be longer. A favorite scene of mine is just when Brolin at the beginning fights Timothy Chalamet. They're like training and they have those suits, like the blue suits, like the force field barrier thing. Those looked like shit in the 84 version. These look pretty cool, and I thought that kind of, it had a little exposition to it, but it set up like the technology is going to look good in this movie for the rest of it, I guess. But
yeah. I think maybe a favorite scene was when Paul and what's his mom's name?
Jessica.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm like, isn't that the actress's name? But it's Rebecca. Rebecca, yeah. Jessica. Sound kind of same. Similar. When they are like tied up in by the Harkonnens, like in a ship, and two of them are working. Because you can see like Jessica has like a type of sign language that she uses with Paul and like other people like around her, and she's using it while they're like tied up hostage in the ship, and they're like able to get away like using the voice. I think that was one of the cooler things.
Oh yeah, that's like, really cool.
I don't know, basically it's like a Jedi mind trick type thing. Yeah, there you go, inspiration George Lucas.
Yeah, probably.
But basically like she, like, she's good, like, she's mastered it, but Paul's still working on it, but you can, like, speak to someone in, like, a specific tone, and, like, it sounds all, like, warbly in the mm-hmm. movie, but it's, like, you just, like, look at the person and say what you want them to do, they'll just do it. Mm-hmm. So she, like, looks at this guy, and she's, like, untie us now, you know, and he's, like, oh, and he, like, unties them and stuff, and they're able to, like, commandeer the helicopter thing. And
yeah.
That like was, save themselves.
That was good, like, sound. Like, it's up for sound at the Oscars. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. Like, the, just the voice, because it's just called The Voice, but the way the voice worked, like, yeah, like, that audio just pitch was, like, really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, the helicopter, the thropters were...
Ornithopter, I can't... Watch with subtitles, and I remember seeing them, like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, it's supposed to be, like, a... bug type thing. You're right, it looks like a dragonfly.
Yep, those are cool. This is something that is not mentioned in the movie, and it may be brought up later, but do you remember the Baron, so the villain Stellan Skarsgård says to Oscar Isaac at one point, he calls him cousin. You remember that at all?
No.
So he does. They don't elaborate on the relationship there, but Lady Jessica, who's Rebecca Ferguson, Timothy Chalamet's mom in the movie, she is actually the Baron's daughter.
Ooh. And is that common knowledge, or is that like a secret thing, like in the world of Dune?
I'm pretty sure it's common knowledge, because the whole point of the Bene Gesserit, which is the religion that Lady Jessica belongs to,
yeah,
they're trying to create their own prophet. And so they're basically telling a bunch of people to, like, to have kids to, like, create the perfect bloodline.
Sure.
She tell, and the Reverend Mother, who's, like, the head one, she's, you know, played by, I can't remember her name, but she's in Dexter. She's, like, the mom figure in Dexter.
Oh, yeah. Charlotte Rampling.
Yep. She is, like, the Reverend Mother in this movie. And in the book, she tells...
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
I saw her name mentioned in the trivia. I'm like, when was she in this movie? Okay. But if you say that, that makes sense, because she always has like a veil over her face. Her face
is covered a lot.
And her head, too. So that makes sense.
But her character tells the Baron, like, you need to have a kid, a daughter, so that, like, that daughter can then have a kid with this family to, like, create the perfect bloodline.
Yeah.
And so the Baron forces himself on a woman, and then that kid is Lady Jessica. And because of the way that he had the kid, the Reverend Mother was upset with him and gave him a disease.
Because it was non-consensual?
Basically, yeah. Gave him a disease that made him obese and unable to walk, which is why he's got the floating spine thing.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Maybe it's something they'll touch on later, but I thought it was kind of interesting that they just didn't have that in the movie. Like, they just don't bring up that Lady Jessica's dad is, like, the main villain, but...
Okay.
So there you go. So, and then I guess the whole religion aspect, like, the Bene Gesserit is the main religion of the universe, and they have, you know, the people who worship it, and they have special powers, like the voice, and I like in this movie how in a lot of movies, the one or the prophet's this random thing that happens. Like, it's just this random person that doesn't know they're the one or anything like that. But in this, it's like, no, we're, like, manufacturing it. Like, we know exactly who it will be. Because the whole point of Bene Gesserit is they're almost always women. Which is why, like, Lady Jessica was supposed to have a daughter. She was ordered to have a daughter. But she decided, like, no, I'm going to have a son. And I think he's going to be the one. So you can, like, choose.
Can I decide? Next time around sounds nice.
Yeah. So yeah, she can choose. So she chose to have a son when she was ordered to have a daughter.
Fascinating. Okay.
And that's why.
I don't know if they, like, get into that too much in the movie, and I didn't pick up on it, but I did not know that, so.
There was, like you
I
said.
I think that's interesting.
Like you said, it was one line of dialogue. It's
if you miss it, you miss it.
It's after, which is maybe my favorite scene. I mentioned the one with Josh Brolin. My actual favorite scene is maybe the Gom Jabbar, which is when Paul puts his hand in the box full of pain, and then, you know, she's got the needle next to his head, or to his neck, and if he pulls his hand out, she'll kill him. That might be, it's very early in the movie. It's actually, like, the first chapter of the book, which is funny, but it's after that when they're leaving, and the Reverend Mother is talking to Jessica, and she's like, you were ordered to have a daughter, but you and your ego thought you could produce the Kwisatz Haderach, which is their name of the prophet. So, yeah, she, like, had Paul on purpose with the idea of, like, you're gonna be the one. Because if a male has the powers of the Bene Gesserit, then it's, like, an all-powerful being type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a fascinating take on, like, a prophet to manufacture it. And the whole point of, like, that's why Lady Jessica's dad is the Baron Harkonnen, because, like, yeah, you have a daughter, because then that daughter's going to mate with the Atreides, and then, like, I think they're only one or two generations away from doing it. Like, Paul wasn't supposed to be it, but, like, the next generation maybe was supposed to be, but Lady Jessica's like, no, I think he's going to be it. And they have, like, backups. Like, she said, like, We have multiple options who could be the prophet. Like, we have other males, too, that could be it.
Yeah.
And then they even lay down the groundwork on Arrakis. They, like, spread word of the prophet being there, which is why Paul is, like, worshipped when they first show up. So, it's just the way they handle, like, the whole prophet thing is really different and interesting, I think, in this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another thing I've seen people say is, like, why aren't there guns? And I think the force field suits are supposed to be, like, the reason that guns don't exist in this world, because the whole point of the suits that they wear is if something quick hits it, then it bounces right off, but if something slow enters it, then it'll break the force field. But so if you shoot a gun at it, then you're never going to kill the person because they just bounce off. So I think that's the rationale for kind of resorting back to sword warfare, even though it's this advanced technological world. So I think it's great. I don't really want them to make too many more movies after the first book, because shit gets weird in these books. The second book, obviously big spoilers if you don't want to know future things about the movies, but Paul becomes emperor. They actually cast, he doesn't marry Zendaya. He has her as a concubine, but he marries the emperor's daughter. And they cast that. It's Florence Pugh. Florence Pugh is going to be that role in the next movie.
Yep.
But so Paul becomes emperor, and then he realizes what he would have to do to keep the human race to survive. Because the whole point, like, he can see into the future, and he sees that the human race will eventually go extinct. We'll all die off. And he knows what he has to do to, like, keep us on the path of survival. And he chooses not to do it. Because it's, like, apparently terrible. And, like, things he would have to do in the present are, like, bad things that he would have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so he chooses not to do it. But he ends up having twins at the end of the second book. And he can see into the future. He only knew of having one kid. The daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So the son was not in his visions at all. So his son has the same powers. Like I said, the Kwisatz Haderach was like one generation off. Like, his son is also a prophet and has the same powers. So the third book, his son has the same abilities and decides to, he looks into the future, what he would have to do to keep the human race in existence, and he chooses to do it. And in doing so, he becomes part sandworm, which we didn't even talk about the sandworm, and they're not in it that much, but he becomes part sandworm, where he gets super strength, he's super fast, and he becomes emperor of, you know, the universe, and he becomes a dictator. Because what he has to do, the fourth book jumps ahead 3,500 years into the future. His son is still alive because he is a sandworm. He is a giant sandworm, but he has got a human face and human arms. And he is called God Emperor. Like, he is ruling the universe with an iron fist. He has disbanded space travel, which is apparently the big thing that was going to cause the human race to go extinct.
Okay.
So he's disbanded space travel. Dune is a paradise now, like trees all over the place with one little patch of sand, which is where he lives, because he's a giant sandworm.
Sure.
And then I think he gets killed at the end of that book, and then that's the fourth book, and there's two more after that, and I don't even know what happened. But I'm just like, oh god, this gets weird fast. Like, Paul's son becomes a sandworm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's really, I don't want to see that in a movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I just don't need it. But if they keep making money,
science fiction,
yeah,
fascinating stuff.
It always starts. It starts out as like kind of semi political, right? Political metaphors, messagey, like Star Wars and Dune, and then they just get off the rails, like Jar Jar Binks, and then God Emperor of Dune.
Exactly.
It's back on HBO Max. It was off for a while, but now it is back on HBO Max. If anyone wants to watch it. Next up on our Best Picture nominee review list is West Side Story. No, this isn't 1961. It's 2021, and they redid West Side Story. Who did this?
Who is responsible for this? Steven Spielberg.
That asshole.
Steven Spielberg is responsible for this. It had always been a dream of Steven Spielberg.
Yep.
To do this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Redo this movie. So, here we go. What, 60 years after the original movie release. So yeah, Steven Spielberg directed this. Tony Kushner adapted the screenplay. Acting, we've got Rachel Zegler as Maria, Ansel Elgort as Tony, Ariana DeBose as Anita, David Alvarez as Bernardo, and Rita Moreno is back. She played Anita in the 1961 version. She is back this time playing the shop owner's widow, which character like is mentioned more or less in the 1961.
Yeah. Like, before we saw this, they were like, oh, they made a new role for Rita Moreno. And then we found out, like, oh, no, I mean, she just is the place of the shop owner.
Yes, yes.
So, basically.
Yeah, so she plays Valentina. And then lastly, we have Mike Feist as Riff.
Don't forget Corey Stahl. He is in this movie. He is a person that exists that is in the, he is a well-known actor that I had no idea was in this movie, and he plays a very minor role. The head of the police. Not the head, but like he's from House of Cards. He's in the first Ant-Man movie. He's a villain in the first Ant-Man movie.
I don't even know who you're talking about. I have to look him up.
I would say, yeah, look him up. But he doesn't play Officer Krupke. He's like the detective who like takes the kids aside and says, like, what are you doing fighting over this stuff? Like,
yeah.
Basically saying he's like a terrible person who wants to be racist against Puerto Ricans, but...
Oh, yeah. Okay, I know who you're talking about. This is dumb. I get him confused with Stellan Skarsgård sometimes.
Oh, well, he was in Dune. Did you think this guy was in Dune?
No, well, I don't know. I get them confused. Who's the one that's in Dope Sick?
Which role in
Dope Sick? As one of the attorneys.
Oh, that's that's Peter Sarsgaard.
Peter Sarsgaard.
Who's in the Batman as the DA?
Yeah. Oh, the plethora of Sarsguards.
I don't even think he's related to the other Sarsguards. But right. Yeah.
Sarsguard? Skarsgard.
Skarsgard.
Where does the guy that plays it fall into this?
He's the son of Stellan Skarsgård, who plays the Baron in Dune.
Oh my god.
Not related to the DA from the Batman or the racist cop in West Side Story.
I think that makes sense.
But they're like all in the MCU. I know. Stellan Skarsgård's in Thor. Corey Stahl is in Ant-Man.
Seriously? Yeah. When we watched Dope Sick, and I'm like, I'm so confused by this guy, because I'm like, I really think that he's this, like, always a villain bald guy, but, like, it's not quite fitting in my brain, but that's who I want to say he is. Now I know who that always a villain bald guy is.
Corey Stahl.
I'll never remember his name, but at least now I know that they are different people. Oh my god. Jesus. Okay, off the rails. We're off the rails from the start. Oh my god. Okay.
We're good.
Okay. Budget. Estimated budget of $100 million. Opening weekend in the US drew in just over $10 million. The current worldwide gross is only $75 million.
It's very bad. Corey Stahl, he plays Junior Soprano in The Many Saints of Newark. No, this did dip terribly at the box office.
Yeah,
why did it do? So I can't blame everything on COVID. Like, I can't just blanket towel of COVID. Why didn't people go see this in theaters? This seems like a family-ish movie to see. I mean,
we saw it with family over Christmas.
Yeah, we did, and we were two of six people in the movie theater, two of which were my brother and sister, and then you and me.
Our family was four of the six people.
And then
there.
The two sat in front of us, they were two ladies, and they apparently had no idea what the plot of West Side Story was, which is based on Romeo and Juliet, so you should really know what this is about, but they're very surprised on what was going on.
Okay, yes, I'll save that for the spoilers section, because I think that was
one of my favorites. This is all going to be spoilers. It's Romeo and Juliet. It's West Side Story. It's okay. He dies, she doesn't. That's the only difference between Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, so the women sitting in front of us, when Valentina, the shop owner, she's like, Maria, she's dead. And so one of the women in front of us is like, but she's not dead! Nope.
No,
that's the bait and switch. Yeah. That's the bait and switch. It's Romeo and Juliet.
And when Tony got killed, I think they gasped and were freaking out.
But she's not dead. And I just look at you, I'm like, what's happening right now with these two?
Yep.
Oh, that was good. That was good stuff. Good stuff. That's what's fun about seeing movies in theaters. You get the atmosphere and whatever else is going on from the audience.
Either that, or when we went and saw Spider-Man No Way Home with my brother and sister, there's crying kids in the corner the whole time.
That's the atmosphere.
Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. All I'm saying.
Sometimes we have...
I prefer the atmosphere, let me clarify. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway. Okay, awards.
Yeah, why people didn't say this, I don't know.
Yeah.
Awards, yes. The Golden Globes, they won Best Picture for Musical Comedy. Rachel Zegler won for Lead Actress, and then Ariana DeBose won Supporting Actress. Steven Spielberg was also nominated for Director, did not win. At the SAGs, the only nomination they had at the Screen Actors Guild was, again, for Ariana DeBose for Supporting Actress, and she won. This role of Anita is just...
It's like the most, I don't want to say divert, but like, it's got a wide range of emotions.
Yeah. Let's see, they had five nominations at the BAFTAs. Ariana DeBose won again. They also won for Best Casting, which is kind of a cool award. I don't know, they don't have something to that equivalent at the Oscars. I feel like that's more of a Screen Actors Guild type thing. But Anyway, Academy Awards, we've got 7 nominations. Best Picture, Best Director for Spielberg, Supporting Actress again for DuBose, Production Design, Sound, Costume Design, and Cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Ratings, we just start with IMDb. I'm going to finish up with the IMDb rating because I have a comment on that. Rotten Tomatoes score, very high, 92% critic, 94% audience. Metacritic score is 85. That might be the highest of the Best Picture nominees that I remember, at least. It's fascinating about the IMDb ratings. When I first noted this about a month ago, so it was like mid-February, the IMDb rating was a 7.8. It's currently a 7.4.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing it's because it's on Disney Plus now. More people have seen it. I don't know. But I feel like that's a big drop in just a couple weeks.
Yeah, I don't know. People are like, oh, look at this movie that's about different races mad with each other, and they thought it was political and went, no, lower that rating. Even though it's the same story from 1961, there was very little changed in this.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
that is a big drop-off. It's the same story
as Romeo and Juliet. It was two clashing families that didn't know they could be together.
I felt like they made it two different races in West Side Story, but yeah, that is a decent drop off. I don't know if it was parents turning it on for their kids for some reason and then going, oh, this is more adult than I thought it would be, but mad people lowering the score, I don't know.
Could be.
Did you have any trivia? Trivia. I'm trying to sing it because it's West Side Story trivia.
I got a few notes here. So, Stephen Sondheim was the original lyricist for, the stage production. Sadly, he passed away just a few days before this movie was released in theaters. He did get to see a final cut of the version. Final cut version of the film. So, he did see it before he passed, but just sad timing on that. Mentioned a little bit before, Steven Spielberg has been wanting to do a reimagining of this musical for a long time. He's always appreciated the theme, the divide between the Sharks and the Jets, and he said he feels like it's even more important to tell that story today than it was back in the 50s. The biggest thing that he wanted to change was that he insisted that all of the Puerto Rican, Latinx characters were actually played by people with that heritage.
Yeah, because, who would have guessed that Natalie Wood, who played Maria in the original 61 version, she's not Latino.
And the actor who played Bernardo, did brown face, straight up.
For some reason, because he won the Oscar in the original 61 version, I thought him and Rita Moreno were, the only Latino.
I think there's someone else as in the gang, but I feel like the main guy was not. He at least, I don't know, looked weird. But Spielberg even, working with casting and stuff, he said, I even want, a broad range of ethnicities for ad diversity, too. Rachel Zegler is of Colombian descent. Ariana DeBose, she's Afro-Latina, so he wanted to have further diversity within the cast, too, which I thought was lovely. This is kind of a cool tie back to the 1961 film. So Mike Feist originally auditioned for the role of Tony in this new version, but was eventually cast as Riff. And the exact same thing happened with Russ Tamblyn. He auditioned for Tony and was cast as Riff in the 61 version. Yeah. So very similar things there. That's what I got.
Okay. So Rita Moreno initially declined being in this movie because she thought it was just going to be a cameo.
Then
found out it was a bigger part, so she accepted. Rachel Zegler was cast straight out of high school. She'd literally done, nothing. She just... And then did this. So there you go. This marks the first and last time Spielberg will direct a musical. He says it's the only musical he would ever want to do or do.
Yeah.
And with this Best Director nomination, he becomes first person nominated for Best Director over 6 different decades.
Whoa!
So 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, 2020s.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Crazy.
That's a great stat. I like that.
Yeah. No subtitles in this movie, which I appreciated. So they speak, you know, Spanish, obviously, like, throughout the movie in different parts. And they didn't put subtitles up, which I appreciate, because it's one of those things you can kind of tell what they're saying without having to read what they're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was, like, a cool little... Like, if subtitles were there, I don't think it'd be that huge of an issue, but it was kind of nice that they're able to kind of act it out without you having to know exactly what they're saying. And, yeah, Marina also said she described shooting the scene where Valentina saves Anita as difficult because... She has well-documented experiences with sexual assault in Hollywood. So she said that that was kind of a tough scene, understandably so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's all I got, too. So, I know, this has all been spoilers because it is, like, you know the story of West Side Story. So, what are some things you liked or disliked about the movie?
I thought... The choreography in this was amazing. All of the dance, like all of the songs, it's just done so well. And take everything that I say with the caveat that I had no exposure to West Side Story before seeing this movie. I hadn't seen it on stage before. I hadn't seen the 1961 movie. Like, straight up, this is my first exposure to West Side Story. Except I had heard a few of the songs before. But, I seriously, the choreography was so good. The song In America.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, with the bright dresses and they're dancing out in the sunlight. And it's just like a party down the street, basically. It was so fun. And especially comparing it to the 61, I'm like, ooh, same. I like how they changed that. And, honestly, I think one thing that they did really well in this version was when Tony and Maria are first, like, when they're singing Tonight, like, on the fire escape, like, right after, like, they first meet each other at the dance. It's, like, such a strong metaphor as, like, he's literally behind bars at one point, like, under the fire escape, where it's, like, here is a physical barrier between you two. He has been in jail before. Like, I liked... How strong the metaphor was in that. And I think it was choreographed really well instead of the 61 where he's pretty much just standing in the street the whole time. I think Spielberg did a good job of making it feel fresh and interesting, but it still felt like it honored the version before it.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect update of an older film. I flat out think it's better than the original one.
Same.
I think that watching the original one after seeing this one, the original one feels like a lot of small dance numbers. Like, the America is just two people dancing. I think it's just Bernardo and Anita dancing on a rooftop. I
think that's all right.
I think that's all it is. Whereas this, like you were saying, America is like this giant, bright... scene going down the streets, which was maybe my favorite scene of the movie. It's the perfect update in the sense of it's got updated dialogue. I feel like it's real people talking to each other instead of like a play or a musical. Just the dialogue feels different. This felt like an actual real people talking to each other. It's got a more updated editing, like quicker cuts and faster paced things at certain points. And yeah, so I don't know, I just feel like it's like the angles, the production design, like everything is just updated to make it more realistic in a sense. So yeah, I just think it's the perfect update. They didn't really change a whole lot. I feel like some of the songs were in different places a couple times, but yeah, that didn't really matter. Like in some places I thought it was better. Like in the original one, I Feel Pretty was right after we see Tony kill Bernardo. So it was just weird going from a death to, oh, I feel pretty. I'm like, that's a weird transition. And in this one, was it before?
It was just before. Because it's like, right? they're cleaning in the store, and as the women are all punching out, that's when Chino comes up.
Yeah. Which, and Chino is someone I think they did better in this version, too. In the old one, I felt like he was just there, and then all of a sudden he's the guy to kill them, to looking for Tony to kill in the end. And in this one, they kind of gave him a little more to work with or to do. You know, he's the one who is originally supposed to go out with Maria. He's viewed as this nerd, and then he, you know, obviously gets upset after Tony kills Bernardo, and he's going to take revenge on him. Like, I don't know, I felt like they did a little bit more of that character. So, yeah, no, the acting's great. Zegler and DeBolus and the guy who played Bernardo are probably, like, my three favorite. I don't think the guy who played Bernardo is getting enough love. I thought he was great in it.
He was really good.
Also, did you see Rachel Zegler? She was not invited to the Academy Awards.
Yep.
But then today, in their final slate of presenters, they put her name on it. So she is going to the Academy Awards now.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. But the star of Best Picture nominee not getting invited to the Academy Awards. Whatever.
Insane.
I just think it's not much has changed. It's just a perfect update. And I think a lot of the actors just fit their roles. The guy that plays Riff, like, just, he looks like it should just be named Riff. He looks like he's pulled out of the 1940s or wherever this takes place.
Yes, no, I kind of went through, like, the four, five, six main characters in this and kind of compared the 61 with the 21 version, like, who's the better one? Hands down, this Riff. He's so good. Like, you can just, like, feel his schmarminess, like, come across, and he's just, like, like you said, it seems like he fits, like, right in that scene. I said, if Ben Mendelsohn ever needs, like, a younger version of himself or, like, a son to play him in a movie, TV show, because he plays a very similar kind of character where he's just usually kind of a icky kind of guy. Yep, you can get Mike Feist. Hire him.
Yeah, there you go.
We've got a very similar vibe.
There are things that I don't love about it, which is just because of, the, you know, it's the same in the original and it's the same in Romeo and Juliet. I still don't love how she immediately forgives and then sleeps with Tony after he kills her brother.
Yep.
Like, he's still got his blood on him.
Yep.
Like, he's like, hey, I killed your brother 5 minutes ago. I just want to be straight up with you. Oh, look at this bed. Let's have sex on it. Like, that's, like, basically what happened.
And they've known each other for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Which, like, love at first sight's one of those things, like, okay, suspension of disbelief, whatever. They just, whatever. Like, if it was just that, I would still bring it up, but, you know, I'd have less of a deal with it. But, like, the whole, I just, and it wasn't really an accident either. Like, he made that decision, like, I'm killing your brother.
Yeah.
Like, I know it was kind of one of those, he killed my best friend, I'm angry, so I'm going to kill you. But, like, he still made that decision to do it.
Yeah.
And then Maria's just like, yeah, no, I still love you. Come on.
That I barely know.
Yeah, exactly. The brother you've known literally your whole life, like, you came over to this country, and, yeah, like, you're throwing that away for him? that's stuff that I have a hard time with. And I get, like, that is what happened in the 61 version and probably what happened in the 57 Broadway play and is what happened in Romeo and Juliet. But it's still something, like, that it's tough for me to get past.
Isn't it crazy how storylines like that continue to persist? It's like,
you could probably have changed that a little bit by now.
It's so unbelievable.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. DeBose is fantastic. She will win the Oscar for this, and, like, rightfully so. She's great. What is the motivation towards, like, lying about Maria, though? Because she goes to the store to tell Tony to meet Maria at the bus station. And then she does get borderline. I mean, like, if it wasn't for Rita Moreno's character, like, she's going to get sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I don't know if it's just she's in the moment pissed at all these people and just goes, no, I'm going to lie and say Maria's dead. I don't know why she does that exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. It's similar to how, you know, I say, oh, okay, this was in the last version. It's in Romeo and Juliet. I don't know. I don't know why that's there. That's a good point.
I don't know. I feel like it's just something that would happen in a play, and they just brought it into the movie, I guess. But
yep.
Did you have any... What are your favorite musical parts? America, I think, is just, like, number one for me. I do like... what's the one with the gun?
When it's just riff and cool. Tony.
I think it's just called Cool.
That's probably one of the best, like, sets in the movie, because they're on this, like, pier, like, over the water, and they're just, yeah, I liked that one a lot.
Yeah. I thought it was, I like it a lot. I do think it's, like, they're just fighting over this gun that, I know it's a musical, so they just break out in song and dance, but, like, that thing could go off at any second.
Accurate.
I Feel Pretty was done better. I don't know, did you have any standout ones?
Yeah, that was good. Not anything else besides what I've already talked about. So, I liked In America. I loved Tonight. It was good.
Yeah, the balcony scene was really good.
Yeah.
So, I've got a list here. So, this is a remake of a Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
I've got a list of other remakes of Best Picture winners. You want me to go from oldest to most recent or vice versa?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. So in 2016, Ben-Hur got remade.
Oh, that's right. It Morgan, was garbage, Morgan wasn't Freeman. It?
I never saw it, but yeah. Me neither. 25% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ouch.
Around the World in 80 Days was remade.
Jackie Chan?
Jackie Chan, because that won Best Picture in 56. In 2004, it was remade. 32% on Rotten Tomatoes. All the King's Men, which won Best Picture in 1949. Was remade with Sean Penn in 2006. That's 11% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, wow.
Hamlet, which won Best Picture in 48, I want to say, Hamlet's a weird one where it's like, that's just Shakespeare, so they remake it into a million different things. But the Kenneth Branagh one came out in 1996, and that's like, it was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, including writing, so that's a little bit better.
Okay.
And then... Until West Side Story, this is maybe the quote-unquote best example. Mutiny on the Bay, which won Best Picture in the 40s, I want to say, or 30s. Or Bounty, sorry. Mutiny on the Bounty was nominated in the 30s or won in the 30s or 40s. Was remade in 1962 with Marlon Brando and was nominated for Best Picture. So those are the only examples I have. But like it was weird to me, like West Side Story is a remake of a Best Picture winner, and it's nominated for Best Picture. I guess it's happened before, but, I mean, there's a lot of shit here, too, in the recent years.
A lot of crap there.
Yeah. And this is also, I mean, this is clearly one of Spielberg's better movies, I think. But it's one of his best movies in a while. I got a list of his most recent-ish movies here.
Yeah.
And I want to see, like, where if you think West Side Story is better or worse than a lot of these. So,
okay.
Ready Player One. I think this is better than Ready Player One.
Yeah. I liked Ready Player One more than most people, but West Side Story is better than that.
So I made sure to include all of his Best Picture nominees on here, too. So The Post.
Oh, that was fine.
Fine is maybe... on the better end for me. Like, that movie is, I guess, fine is probably the best way to... I don't think it's that good. I think it was nominated for 2 Oscars, and it was, like, Best Picture and then Meryl Streep, because she gets nominated for everything.
Yeah, it's because she's good at everything.
Yep. Bridge of Spies, which I think is overrated. I don't think is that great. Mark Rylance has won an Oscar for that one. Lincoln, Daniel Day-Lewis winning for that.
Okay.
War Horse...
Oh, yeah, you brought that up recently.
Yeah, I don't think that's a very good movie. This movie doesn't exist, but IMDb tells me it does. Indiana Jones and the
Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
If that movie were to exist, I would say West Side Story is better than that. Munich, which Eric Bana's in, was nominated for Best Picture, Director, a bunch of stuff like in 2005. And then Catch Me If You Can and Minority Report came out in 2002.
I love both of those movies.
Yeah, and then like AI in 01 or 2000, and then Saving Private Ryan 98. Mm. So, I mean, you could argue this is his best movie, like, since Catch Me If You Can or Minority Report. Like, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Because Spielberg's been on the kind of a Because there's a lot of not great stuff in between all this, like the BFG, which like isn't a terrible movie, but that's not like a normal Spielberg gem of a movie. So I don't know. I think this is like a good, like Spielberg is back in true form, getting a legitimate Best Director nomination. Like this movie is a legitimate Best Picture. Like this is a high-end Spielberg movie in my opinion, not just a this movie's getting a Best Picture nomination because his name's on it type thing.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. After all this, I haven't said my score yet. It's a 9.2 for me.
Nice. Where does that rank amongst other musicals, Matthew?
Ooh.
For you.
Probably up there. I'm not a huge musical fan, so I mean, it has to be up there for sure.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I have the issues with it, like I mentioned, but like overall, this is just a very fun, enjoyable movie.
It was very fun.
To watch.
Yes.
So yeah, I didn't know what I was expecting with this.
Same.
But it was very, very good.
So good. Mm-hmm. I gave it an 8.7. One thing that we haven't touched on yet is I loved, like the film style, like the colorization. It's made to look kind of like the film of the 50s, 60s. I like that sort of thing. It's not quite as noticeable. Like something I like to compare to is like, I always think of like the very beginning of The Aviator where it's like very like blue, red kind of shift. It's like it's not like that, but it's definitely noticeable where you're like, okay, this has like that vintage sort of hue to it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I really appreciated too. So they made it feel like it was still set in the 50s, so mm-hmm. I liked that. Great movie.
Yeah. Great movie. On Disney Plus, if we didn't say that already. So there you go. All right, and then just two more movies after this. So that's the show today. Make sure to follow us on social media at OscarRealPod on Twitter, on the Instagram, or on the line, Exchangegram.
Exchangegram.
And make sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening. If you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, I guess it's called these days. When's the last time it was called iTunes? I don't know why I said that. But on Apple Podcasts.
You freaking millennial. You and your iTunes.
You calm down, you boomer at heart, you. leave us a review and a rating. Help us out. The more you listen, the more you review, the higher we climb in the charts. And it's almost nothing on your end. You just click that five-star button, and it helps us out immensely. Also, check out my YouTube channel. I've been posting. I'm going to post like snippets of reviews and stuff on there to check out too. So, yeah, from Matt and Haley, this has been the Oscar Real Movie Podcast.